I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. What is the good life? That's a question an upcoming exhibition organized by the Van Allen Institute will explore. Its curator, Zoe Ryan, is with us to talk about the good life, new public spaces for recreation, and what cities can learn from the 70 architectural projects it showcases. Pop City Pittsburgh and Model D showcase the good life each week in Pittsburgh and Detroit. They are online products from Issue Media Group, and its founder, Brian Boyle, is here to tell us why urban America needs a new narrative today on Smart City. But first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. What is the good life? That's a question the Van Allen Institute will explore in September when its new exhibition opens. It is called, appropriately, The Good Life, New Public Spaces for Recreation, and it will be on display at Pier 40 on Hudson River Park in New York. The exhibition will feature 70 significant architectural projects redefining uses for public spaces around the world. And with us to tell us about it is the Van Allen Institute Senior Curator, Zoe Ryan. Zoe, how is the good life defined today in a city like New York?
New York was obviously the inspiration, I think, for the show. Our work is based in New York. Van Allen Institute is based in New York. But we always try and look within an international context of case studies and sort of lessons to learn and try and bring that back to a local context to inform current dialogues. One thing in particular, the Design Excellence Program, for example, initiated by Mayor Bloomberg, is ensuring that that design at the highest quality is being produced in the city, and it's inspiring new and innovative projects and tapping into really new talent. If we look at three of the projects in the Good Life show, for example, the High Line on the west side of Manhattan, or the development of the East River waterfront, or even the redevelopment of Lincoln Center in Midtown. For me, these are three projects that address very critical issues for public space and recreational public spaces: the adaptive reuse of formerly industrial structures, a railroad elevated above ground, if you think of the High Line, or reclamation of our waterfronts happening, you know, in cities around the world, formerly 19th century industrial sites now being sort of transformed into with new uses and bringing together different types of people, not just, you know, workers, thinking about the East River. And then Lincoln Center, a space which is very iconic, but through a redesign, being able to retool and update these spaces to make them very much more accessible and inclusive and really connecting people and places and coming back to that idea of cities as melting points. And I think in a city like New York, there is just such a diversity of projects that are just taking off. These are just a few examples. I mean, many others, and especially for us, it was important to think of Pier 40 also as a site of renovation, as we're going to be opening the exhibition on this space, and it's undergoing its own redevelopment as a recreational venue.
How can good design be assured?
I think initiatives such as the Design Excellence Program, but also just tapping into a range of talent, looking beyond the usual suspects, if I may say that, and sort of tapping into maybe more emerging talent or enabling teams to come together. If you think of the High Line, it was a very diverse team that was put together with Dilla Scafidio and Renfro as the architects, Field Operations as the landscape architects, Piet Uldolf from Holland as the sort of expert on horticulturalist, there were lighting designers, there was Olaf Eliasson, an artist. I mean, together they sort of brainstormed, and I think that makes for a very rich design process. And I think these types of processes are the ones that enable the most innovative projects to happen, and people coming together, not just from the local context, but also internationally, so they can bring their own lessons and what they've, you know, been thinking about to the table.
The exhibit is built around five themes. What are they?
The five themes are the cultural city, the fun city, the 24-hour city, the healthy city, and the connected city. The themes are an armature for exploring the projects, and they're by no means exhaustive. They allow us to sort of show a cross-section. They were derived from what I saw occurring, sort of fielding hundreds of projects that we looked through, some of the main ideas that I saw kept cropping up when thinking about spaces for recreation. If we think of cultural spaces, they're since something that's been inspired by an increased interest in the arts and culture as a driver in cities, and how much our cities are valued for producing culture and, you know, exciting artistic projects, and obviously design as well. But also that the city needs flexible spaces that can be accommodating for multiple activities, both programmed and unscripted. So a lot of the thinking around the themes was very timely ideas. I think thinking of the healthy city, for example, very self-explanatory. I think we all want to live in greener, healthier and safer cities. But I think the quality of the environment is a barometer of a community, and these projects are a way of evaluating the quality of life, just not for the planet, but also its citizens. I think all of the themes have multiple ways of looking at them and multiple things you can take from them. Thinking of the connected city, it's about connecting people, but it's also about connecting neighbourhoods and communities and places. So you do have this mixing of people and spaces. Same for the 24-hour city. That was very much inspired by looking at projects such as the World Trade Centre site or even Lincoln Centre, these enormous sort of district-wide centres that have the mixing of people, space, activities, the diversity of experiences I was talking about, and really are there to necessitate exchange of ideas that can give a meaning to life, but are essential sort of spaces where everything comes together and you do get this sort of melting pot. I think the fun city is often something that's very much overlooked in the city. Too often fun is sort of squeezed out, but play has been shown to be vital for human development, and it's definitely not just something for kids. If you think of the Hudson River redevelopment right at the moment, I mean, you see people of all ages enjoying the waterfront. I think play spaces are often essential meeting spaces for all different types of people from all kinds of backgrounds, cultural, economic, for example. And Leanne Lefebvre, an art historian in Holland, has discussed this a lot on her travels. She sort of looked at Shanghai and how they have different play equipment on the street for people of all ages, and I sort of witnessed this recently in Istanbul. And so the projects there are very much about, you know, bringing people of all ages together to share common experiences and sort of be able to take part in the city and have some fun.
Tell me about Pier 40.
We have a long, Van Allen Institute has a long history with Pier 40. This is sort of taking us full circle. In 1998, Van Allen Institute organised a public ideas competition for the site when it began rethinking its place on the waterfront and what it wanted to be. And it was no longer used as this industrial pier site, but they wanted to think more into the 21st century. And it was sort of slowly becoming a recreational venue. It has soccer fields on the ground and actually on the roof as well. So we had held this ideas competition just to generate thinking and stimulate the beginnings of a dialogue. And we actually held the jury in the space on the southwest corner, which the exhibition will be in, which is a 4,500 square foot space that opens up to the waterfront. And for us, it was very important to, we are an institution dedicated to improving the design of the public realm, but our gallery is on the sixth floor in a building on West 22nd Street, and I've always wanted to do a project that was actually out in public space, and that's why I approached Hudson River Park Trust, who very kindly agreed to give us the space and allow us to launch this exhibition. And Pier 40 is almost like one of the projects. It's at the sort of beginnings of being rethought, and it's the RFQ is just about to go out. I think it will go out right at the beginning of the exhibition. So people will be able to come to the site and hopefully will take with them, you know, inspiration from, you know, the more than 70 projects that are shown here of all variety of different scales, and then go away and actually think about their own city and how Pier 40, it's this huge site, could be really utilised and become the linchpin, I think, from the Hudson River Park development.
What is it these projects have in common?
All the projects incorporate more than one theme. I think that's very important to stress, that they can easily overlap one theme to the other. And I think that's important because they have, you know, multiple access points to them. You can think about them on multiple levels. But I've tried to highlight something that's particularly innovative or essential to current dialogues, whether that's remediation of a brownfield site and transformation of it into an exceptional public space, such as the Olympic Sculpture Park in Seattle, or a very tricky site in Rio de Janeiro, the Metropolitan Park, which is situated on a sort of wasteland between the favela communities and the much more middle-class communities. And it's hoped that it will create this recreational venue with a lot of activity, but it will also create connecting points where hopefully the two disparate sides of this community will somehow come and almost meet in the middle. Another very interesting project is in Soweto, the mountain, Soweto Mountain of Hope, a former garbage dump, a very dangerous site, was sort of transformed by the community by sort of two, spearheaded by Mandla Mentor and Katie Marks, an architect from the UK, who sort of spearheaded this community arts initiative to transform this site and turn it into something that was, you know, that could be used, where people would come back and was just not this eyesore in the city, but was actually a thriving public place. I think these are case studies, but they each tell a story. There's great narratives to these projects. They all deal with, you know, a lot of tricky issues. They range in scale. Some are conceptual. For example, there's this great project, the Park and Jog project in Manchester, the UK. It's very much on the conceptual level right now, but it's rethinking the commute to work, that it doesn't necessarily need to be by car or vehicular transportation, but maybe we can swim to work or cycle or ride our horses to work. I mean, they've sort of taken the idea of the park and ride concept, which is, you know, it's just been used throughout the world now, which is the idea of driving to one site where you pick up a bus and that takes you into the centre of the city, so sort of reduce traffic. And they're sort of, rather than doing that, maybe you'll drive to a site where you can connect to a swimming lane and swim the rest of the way in and meet up with a, you know, a sort of complex at the end where you can change into your suit and go to work. So although it sounds sort of fun and maybe a little out there right now, some of these concepts are grounded in very fundamental issues. I mean, one of the other concepts that I love is Velo City in Toronto, Canada, which is a concept by Chris Hardwick for a series of overland sort of highways for bikes, because apparently in Toronto it's a, you know, bike lover's city, and there really isn't that much in the way of spaces catering or many bike lanes. So Chris Hardwick came up with this concept, and I think some of them are just, they're just very inspirational, and hopefully they will sort of set the groundwork or set seeds which can later be sort of rethought and connected back into city planning initiatives.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Zoe Ryan. She is senior curator and editor of the Van Allen Report. As you sought projects to include in the exhibition, what did you learn about what makes successful public places?
One of the things that I did learn is that spaces really do need to be flexible to change over time. Our needs and our interests change, of course, and spaces need to allow for programmed activity, but also the unprogrammed, the spontaneous activities that just enliven spaces and make us want to be there. But also, I think something that's at the heart of the Good Life Project is the idea of inclusivity and accessibility, allowing for this diversity of people and activities that in turn encourage interaction rather than separation, fostering this interaction and hopefully leading to understanding and tolerance. And I think I learned that through a number of the projects. But also that we can design spaces with strong identities. I think we've sort of veered away from, you know, as I said, we need flexible spaces, so we've sort of veered away from over-programming spaces. But there's something to be said of creating spaces that then engage a variety of programs through encouraging the sort of broad mix of, you know, people from different cultural backgrounds or economic groups, and spaces that can allow us to, you know, foster creativity and exchange of ideas and self-expression, but also collective activities.
How much of their success is determined by the design, and how much by their location and their subsequent management and operations?
It's absolutely vital that the approach is integrated. Of course, design is essential, and an inspirational design is sort of the first part of the puzzle, but there are obviously public policy and location and maintenance are all part of this process, and definitely you can't have one without the other. And an innovative and inspiring design always takes into account the location and the site and the community and the range of uses. And the subsequent life of the project after it's completed, one is completely dependent on another for success, and this shouldn't be overlooked.
Among the 70 projects you showcase in the exhibit, were any driven by or developed by the private sector?
There are a number of public-private partnerships. Think of Lincoln Center, for example, in New York. There's a very interesting project in Copenhagen, the High Square, which is a terrace landscape above a shopping center. It's sort of the biggest department store in Denmark, Magasin du Nord. And on the roof of this, Julian de Schmet, an architect from Copenhagen, and Bjarke Engels are proposing a recreational terrace that's multiple levels that has these amazing views across the water, across the city. And for them, it's a very unique space, something that, you know, you can't find in Copenhagen right now. It allows you to be above ground on a public space. I think this is one of the things that I do find that's very essential to the projects in the show. They're all very unique in their own way. They bring something to the cities that they're working in that is not existing. So it's a completely new experience. I think that's important to say. Another project, for example, in Taichung in Taiwan, is a contemporary music centre. It's a sort of mixed public-private initiative for a new music venue with workshops and studios and an outdoor amphitheatre, sort of driven by the interest in Asian contemporary popular music. But it will also have, the idea is to have the spaces engage also sports and recreation in the fields around it. So the spaces are enlivened 24 hours a day, even when in between programs and after the curtain call.
You mentioned Lincoln Center. What is it about Lincoln Center and projects like that that help them stand the test of time?
I think Lincoln Center it's an iconic building, and it's one of the few remaining mega sort of block structures. We think of the World Trade Center site, we think of Bankside in London. I think it really is it's something that sticks in your mind. The spaces are iconic. They're sort of monumental when you go there. It's a space that you visit. It's very much a destination. I think what's interesting about the sort of redesign by Dilla Scafidio and Renfro is it's not meant to sort of flatten what's there and start again. We're not destroying the iconic architecture, but rethinking it, opening it up, making it more accessible, adapting it to contemporary times, and learning from what didn't work on the space, that these sort of windswept plazas were not inviting and didn't create activity. The only activity was sort of going to the performances, but there isn't anything else to do there. So once you get there, you know, now there's going to be benches and many more trees to make the area more inviting. It's going to be this elevated lawn at the centre, which will be sort of the public gathering point, and there will be a restaurant underneath. So there'll be many more things to bring people together. I think one of the things it taught us as well is that you can have traffic and pedestrians together, that this does create vitality, and we seem to like the density. And I think by opening up the streets around Lincoln Center to traffic, this will also help to enliven the site.
Did you find evidence of new technologies being put to good use in the projects you reviewed?
I think it's very interesting when you think of a group like NYC Wireless, who are developing various hotspots around the city with information that you can access on your, you know, handheld devices or on your computer, laptop. And this is information that the public uploads about, you know, you can be standing in the West Village and you can gain access to information about, you know, local restaurants or playgrounds or, you know, places to visit. To me, that's interesting, and that seems to be something that can definitely, I can see a future in and can be really developed. I think it's very interesting. A project that's in the exhibition on a very grand scale is by Atopia, and it's for the Battersea Power Station in London. This, I think, 30-acre site is being transformed into a cultural and arts complex with offices and hotels, a very mixed-use site. And Atopia is developing a site-wide communications network. So as soon as you enter the site, you'll be able to download information on your, you know, handheld computer or PDA about the activities on the site, about menus from restaurants, or sharing information with people, being able to tell other people who are not on the site what's going on. But really connecting the buildings, the spaces, and people in a very interesting way. And I think these kind of projects, as they get developed further, and obviously are very much in the nascent stage, hopefully we'll see sort of new ideas coming out that go beyond some of the existing technologies we've seen.
Which architectural firms do you think are doing their best work in the public realm today?
I mentioned Dilla Scifidio and Renfro, and I think they're doing just fantastic work right now. The range of projects, very innovative use of not trying to concentrate on creating very commercial spaces. Think of the High Line. Their entire premise with field operations was to create a slow space, a space where you can just amble along the elevated highway for 22 city blocks, taking in the diversity of different environmental landscapes that will be up there, but not necessarily trying to create spaces where there'll be lots of restaurants or cafes or places to shop. I think another interesting architect is David Ajay from the UK, who's, for me, the idea store in the exhibition is one of the most interesting projects. It's the rethinking of traditional library spaces, and he developed a concept and which has been built in London, in East London, in a very ethnically diverse neighbourhood.
Based on your research for this show, what are designers missing? What is it that they ought to understand about public realm projects that they don't?
I think it's important for public spaces to allow for opportunities to reflect on life. I think by this I mean that we need spaces that are hybrid, that allow for multiple activities, as I said before, and this idea of accessibility, but the places that really do foster self-expression and collective activities, and that we don't fear away from people expressing themselves, but we do create places that are welcoming, even given heightened security concerns or, you know, the increased surveillance of public space. I think the projects in the exhibition, one thing they do show is that, you know, people are still optimistic about public space, and they do feel like this is the most important space where people of all backgrounds do come together to share experiences. I think one of the things I said before is I would just like to reiterate is that, you know, I really do feel like the design is possible in public space, and spaces can be designed with strong identities and need to be designed with strong identities and engaging programs. And then it's important that people feel connected to their environment and they feel a sense of belonging and feel good being there. To me, that's the essential quality of the good life.
The exhibit opens when?
It opens on September the 8th, and it runs through October the 1st at Pier 40. It's on the west side of Manhattan, on the West Side Highway, and the cross street is Houston Street.
And will there be a catalogue?
Yes, there will be a 112-page catalogue that will be produced. It's being designed by Project Projects, and the exhibition design is by Work AC. I want to give a shout-out to my excellent design team. The catalogue will come out at the opening of the exhibition.
Zoe, thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you very much.
Zoe Ryan is senior curator and editor of the Van Allen Report. After a short break, we'll return to talk with Brian Boyle about his new online publications about life in cities, and we'll visit with Otis White about disappearing middle-class neighborhoods. Smart City is made possible by the generous support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Tourism Foundation of the Convention and Visitors Bureau, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis and the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, a recent report from Brookings found that middle-class neighborhoods are disappearing from cities. Tell us about it.
Brookings, just, I don't know where they got this idea, but it just, the analysis is fascinating. They started with the question of where do people live in cities? Do they live amongst their own income classes, or are their neighborhoods more mixed? That is, are you more likely to find middle-class people living within a few blocks of wealthy people and lower-income people. And I guess most people, if they thought about this, would guess, well, they probably stick to their own kind, right? What's interesting about this is that Brookings found this is not the way it has traditionally been in cities, that there has been a lot more mixing of income classes than you would have thought. For instance, in 1970, 28% of families in the 100 largest metropolitan areas in the country were considered middle class, and I'll explain in a minute what that means. But 58% of the neighborhoods were middle class. So you have about twice as many neighborhoods that can be classified as middle class than families. And by the way, the definition is 80% to 120% of the regional median income is what Brookings considered to be middle class.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the way it was, and it's very democratic in 1970. What's it like now? Well, the percentage of the families that are middle class have declined. Some the median income has remained where it is, but the but percentages of wealthy and poor have grown. But the percentage of neighborhoods in these metropolitan areas have declined even more. It was 58% back in 1970. Only 41% of neighborhoods in these 100 large metropolitan areas are considered middle class. So what happened? Well, just as families either went to upper middle class or to the lower classes, so did the neighborhoods. Some went up, some went down. Los Angeles lost 8.7% of its middle class families, but 24% of its middle class neighborhoods. So that's the way it is in cities. Are the suburbs any different? Well, Brookings found that there really are only the percentage of families in the suburbs that are considered middle class are only a little bit higher than in cities, and there's been a similar erosion of the neighborhoods. The result of all this is a lot of people are worried that we're losing some of the democratic underpinnings of our society because we're having less and less opportunities for people of different income classes to live in pretty much the same parts of town.
Yeah, this is not good news for America.
No, it's not.
Do you know of any cities who are tackling this problem head on?
No. I wish there were. Everybody talks about it, but nobody has found a good strategy for dealing with it. One of the great problems is the cost of housing is simply separating the rich and the poor in this country, and that's a tragedy.
Mm. Otis, we'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
Otis White is a regular columnist for Governing Magazine. Brian Boyle is reinventing the way cities get covered in the press. He started his own group of online publications in Detroit, Grand Rapids, and Pittsburgh as part of his firm, Issue Media Group. Brian, circulation is down at daily newspapers. What makes you believe that the time is right for a new publication aimed at urban readers in cities like Detroit and Pittsburgh?
Well, I think historically, traditional media, based on their mission, does a really great job every day telling you five or six reasons to disinvest from cities. The narrative that traditional media creates around cities is really focused on crime, blight, abandonment. And I think for urban enthusiasts and people that are really kind of want to be intellectually engaged in thinking about cities, it's hard to find localized information about what's going on in the city and build and connect to a community of people that are taking a thoughtful approach about the future of the city.
Why do you think urban newspapers that have an investment in cities being successful, why do you think they're stuck on that narrative?
I don't know. Keep in mind, I spent a significant amount of my background with traditional media. And, you know, there is a hierarchy of things that get front page coverage in a newspaper or that your all news stations, whether it's TV or radio, are going to focus on. And it starts with rape, and then it's murder, and then it's armed robbery. You know, their mission is to tell you what happened today and to get your attention around it. And their belief is that the thing that's going to get people's attention and the themes that you want to build frequency around are things that are bad.
Mm-hmm.
I find it interesting because, to me, it's the transformation of cities and the transformation of economies and where do we go is a much more interesting content area to play in than what they want to focus on.
But much tougher to cover.
Well, it takes a lot more energy and research. I mean, it seems to be a more sophisticated conversation than they want to have. There's some really good reporters out there that do it really, really well. So, I don't want to slight newspapers and what they do. I read newspapers a lot for specific reasons. You know, I engage in online media and in conversations around topics for other reasons.
When you began the Issue Media Group, were you thinking that there was a gap in the market in terms of content, in terms of style, or in terms of the medium?
I think people in a region want to see their city do well. And I think it's you know, for people that are interested in cities, I think there's a tremendous gap, particularly when it comes to development and where people are investing money and making money, and at the neighborhood level. And again, when you go into any city, you'll inevitably have people talk about what a unique, authentic place the city is, but no one's developing stories around that. So I think our content model, one, is distinct in how we've organized it and the themes that we focus on. I think there's gaps in those three areas. And secondly, I think our content model complements a number of disconnected efforts that are going on in cities and regions.
Tell me about your publications. Who are you trying to reach and what content are you providing?
We are, if you look at any of the publications, and I don't know if you know anyone listening to the program wants to log on to modeldmedia.com, you'll get a sense that every week we feature a new masthead. We've got really great photographers in each of our markets whose mission is to go out and, from a fresh perspective, capture Detroit and have people, when they open the publication and see the masthead, go, wow, that's Detroit. Every week we author two or three original feature stories, and really the mission of the feature stories, we're looking to really hone in on that alternative narrative and start highlighting remarkable people, remarkable place, development activities, neighborhood transformation, you know, really cover that alternative narrative with original content and original photography.
And you are in which markets?
We are currently in Detroit, Pittsburgh, and Grand Rapids, Michigan.
And the names of the publications in each of those?
The Detroit publication is called Model D. The Pittsburgh publication is called Pop City, which really plays off kind of the Andy Warhol influence,
mm-hmm,
and a mission of kind of making Pittsburgh pop. And the Grand Rapids publication is called Rapid Growth.
Why those three markets?
Well, it's interesting. I'm from Detroit, and so it seemed like a good place to start. We were actually introduced, one of Richard Florida's consultants, a gentleman by the name of Lumisante, who's done some work with the Michigan Governor's Office on a Cool Cities program, was introduced to Model D and contacted us about introducing us to some people in Pittsburgh. So Lou was kind of our entree into a number of stakeholders in Pittsburgh. The state of Michigan, particularly the Housing Authority in the state of Michigan, has become a big supporter and advertiser of ours. And they're interested in initially really, really highlighting Michigan and Grand Rapids and creating really focused guides to understanding neighborhoods in those cities. And we're currently engaged with them against an expanded scope of work that will eventually get us into a number of key Michigan cities.
How is the publication different from market to market?
All of the intellectual thinking comes out of local publications. You know, all of the content, all the writers, all the photographers are bringing a uniquely local perspective to everything that we do. You know, it's interesting because most cities believe that there's kind of misconceptions about the city, and the misconceptions that Detroit feels it has versus Grand Rapids versus Pittsburgh are very different. So we focus on different themes and different myths to break down and really get an understanding of how a city wants to position itself. Grand Rapids, much of our content has been focused on sustainable design and green building because there's they really feel like they're uniquely positioned there. Pittsburgh is really focusing on neighborhoods as an asset and wants to get at kind of the authentic coffee houses and much of the authenticity going on in Pittsburgh, and they're bringing much more of a new economy perspective to what we're doing there. So we're spending more time and energy in Pittsburgh mining out job diversification story and new economy job growth story as the focus of what we're doing. In Detroit, we're really, really focused on, you know, kind of creating a buzz about place and getting people connected to, you know, all the cool stuff going on in Detroit, because it's a different city to kind of navigate and understand than other cities.
And why do you say that? What's different about Detroit?
Well, if you go into, you know, if you're of, you know, kind of this creative class person, and you land in Atlanta or Washington, D.C., in Atlanta you immediately know to go to Little Five Points neighborhood. You know, there's certain neighborhoods in Atlanta or D.C. or Denver or Chicago where this creative class tends to migrate. Detroit's creative community is really fragmented. So if you just get off the bus in Detroit and you look around, it's really difficult city to navigate. But if you get the right tour guide, all of a sudden you understand, wow, there's a lot of interesting pockets of things going on in Detroit that can only happen in Detroit. So much of what we're trying to do is raise the profile of those assets. So, the, you know, kind of the creative class understands how to navigate Detroit and understands where to get plugged into a community of people that they get.
When an article, when a story lands in one of your publications, does it have a particular vibe?
It does. I mean, we're writing specifically for what we call the 8%. In every city, part of what makes the publication unique is who we're writing to. We're writing about and for influencers, people that are going to be the first people to move into neighborhoods and regentrify neighborhoods, people that are going to be entrepreneurs, people that want kind of are going to innovate and want to be on the edge. You know, these early adopters, you know, part of what our mission is to raise the profile of what they're doing to create this sense of density of people that are innovating and use that as a mechanism to drive the wider market faster.
Each publication is a weekly. How many people are you reaching weekly?
In Detroit market, we've been live with Model D in Detroit. We're currently reaching about 150,000 unique visitors every week. We've grown about 25% every month consistently. Pittsburgh publication has been live since March, experiencing the same growth pattern. It started with a much bigger database. So we're currently, through 5 months, reaching about 50,000 unique visitors in Pittsburgh. And Grand Rapids has been live since April. We're reaching about 25,000 unique visitors per month. It's been interesting because my background has been, you know, in the online publishing space for the last 3 or 4 years with Viacom before founding Issue Media Group. And the metrics on the publications, people are spending an average of 14 minutes with each publication, and they're going an average of 10 to 11 pages deep. So the relationship and kind of the need for the kind of content, there is a real need for it.
You're doing publications now in three cities, Grand Rapids, Detroit, Pittsburgh. You are a native of Detroit. Is there anything you've discovered about the three cities, including your hometown, by doing these publications that you did not previously know and that has surprised you?
I left the state after graduating from college. I lived in Boston, Chicago, Denver, and Atlanta. And I think one of the things that I'm continually amazed and surprised by is how unique the vibe and the kind of the organic vibe and culture of each city is. Having people understand that if you're interested and you go to cities and your mission is to explore the authenticity and kind of this unique organic vibe and culture that every city has, it makes the experience of traveling and exploring that much better. I've been really surprised by the regional conversation about the city of Detroit and the conversation you have with people that are involved in Detroit every day is so different. You know, people that really get Detroit don't want to change the city and love Eastern Market and love Corktown and love kind of the fact that only authentic people are in Detroit. Regional conversation is, boy, we better change Detroit. And it's so interesting to, you know, kind of get involved in any of these cities and start to understand the people that are in the cities that people think need to change and evolve, love it. For what it is, and for very different reasons.
But does that create a situation, Brian, where people are, in fact, resistant to change when they need to change?
I think that's a really good question. I know there is some small fragments of the people in Detroit that fight the advancement of the city. I love Detroit. I love it the way it is. I want to see it improve. I think there's a small segment of real hardcore Detroit loyals that don't want to see the city change. I think it creates resistance to, you know, exploring things like transit and exploring ways to really focus on tipping a neighborhood or, you know, really focusing on investing in certain areas of the city and understanding that we can't improve everything in the city.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it creates some resistance to change that's not healthy.
How do you build your mailing list?
We are working with any organization in Detroit, Pittsburgh, and Grand Rapids that is, you know, has a direct or tangential mission of advancing the city, inevitably has a database that they need to get engaged in positive information about the city. So our marketing efforts to date have been largely focused on engaging existing stakeholders, young professional organizations, the Convention Bureau, universities, VCs and entrepreneurial facilities. So organizations that are connected to kind of this influential audience that we're looking to reach and finding a variety of ways to get our content or our publication into their database.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Brian Boyle. He's partner and co-founder of Issue Media Group, based in Detroit. What's been the attitude of daily newspapers toward the publications?
Detroit News has done, and Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, when we first launched in Pittsburgh, did good features on us. It's difficult to answer that question. We can track based on URL who's reading the publication, and the traditional news organizations are some of our most avid readers. So they are engaged in the publication, and we've had a lot of people suggest to us that things that the Free Press or Detroit News or Crane's Detroit Business are doing are in kind of response to what we're doing. So it's been interesting anecdotally to try to understand, are we having an impact on, how those papers portray the city and how they write.
And you think that they aren't doing what you're doing because they're simply stuck in another narrative?
Journalists come to work every day and are looking to dig up big stories. And generally the big stories are someone doing something wrong, or they need to make sure that their point of view is balanced. And whenever you're dealing with the issue being a city, the negative side of that balance is really easy to find. So the mission and the perspective of what they're covering is very different than what we're covering. We are shameless advocates for city. We have a very strong point of view. We're really writing about future. So everything we write about has more of a forward-looking point of view. And we're really coming at things related to city issues from a position of power, meaning we're always framing up solutions and things that can be done. So the mission in the editorial voice, it's just different. And it's really hard to get, journalists to take a different approach to what they do.
How have politicians responded to the publications?
My biggest surprise to date, or one of my biggest surprises to date, the policy audience and getting their attention around the importance of cities and how to advance cities from the perspective of kind of the next generation workforce was really important part of what we wanted to do. We also thought we'd have to work pretty hard to do it. The policy audience has been our most avid and early readers of the publication. The policy community who is looking to advance city issues, it's been really, really exciting to watch how they've leveraged the publication to start getting some traction around issues that are important to them.
But you don't cover politics. Why?
It's hard to cover politics and, advance our mission. Politics divide. We're not looking to divide. We're looking to constantly build a bigger audience around important themes. And we don't understand how to cover politics and not marginalize what we're doing.
But things also get done in cities through politics.
They do. I think part of the benefit of what we're doing from a politician's point of view is that we give them ammunition to talk about what they're doing and why it's important. So I'm not suggesting that we're not apolitical. The evolution of cities and all the issues and themes around cities, it's not a Democrat or Republican thing. It's an advancing the city thing. And I think the more we can do to arm politicians of any political persuasion with access to stories and information that they need to advance their agenda is a good thing.
Do you invite reader response to stories?
It is a really important part of where we want to go. We've had lots of conversations around how are we going to generate user content and start advancing two-way dialogues around key issues and themes. So I think in the next 3 or 4 months, you'll see comment opportunities and blog opportunities extending off of stories in certain sections of the site.
But you're not there yet.
We're not there yet.
Did you see where CNN is making it very easy for viewers to submit content online, photographs, videos, etc., to supplement CNN programming?
Isn't that great?
It's a different world, isn't it?
Our partner in Pittsburgh's husband is a professor at University of Pittsburgh, and he was talking to me about a research paper he read that suggested that Wikipedia content and kind of the notion that a community of people are much smarter than any expert,
mm-hmm.
and how at the academic level it really got all these so-called experts really thinking, geez, what do we do with that?
Yes, the wisdom of crowds.
So I think it's been really exciting for me to see how, big traditional media brands are starting to kind of understand how to leverage the internet in interesting ways.
Are you looking to expand?
We are.
What kinds of cities?
There's a couple initial opportunities for us. One, I think, in growth markets, and you think about Las Vegas or Denver or Phoenix, my sense is that the conversation out there is all about, well, how do we grow smart? And then you've got a different conversation and urgency in, kind of what are considered traditional Rust Belt cities.
Mm-hmm.
And the conversation there is, how do we transform ourselves and how do we reinvent ourselves for kind of the new economy? So I think it's important that we get quickly into a growth market and try to figure out how the content or voice or product might be different. And are we filling the same kind of information void that exists in more of the older cities? I believe the global talent conversation is going to become a much bigger conversation over the next 4 or 5 years. I think people at the national policy level are going to really start trying to get their minds around, wow, immigration policy and our most talented people are leaving this country, and the smart people that used to come here aren't coming here anymore. And how do we reposition, major cities as a huge asset to attract global talent? And I think our concept and approach, if you think about 40 cities in this country having a Model D that talks about its authenticity and its assets in a way that kind of this new economy workforce understands, I think it's going to become more and more important.
Brian, with these publications and with ones you may create in the future, do you want to change cities, or are you simply packaging a particular urban ethos?
I want to change city narrative. I think the word urban has become equated as bad. I think leadership with regards to cities or states has lost sight of how absolutely critical cities are in creating sustainable communities and environments and positioning states and regions for new economies and opportunities. I want people to fundamentally understand where cities need to be prioritized in conversations with regards to how do we advance. And I think to do that, you need a mechanism that creates what we call kind of the sustainable weekly buzz that celebrates cities as unique, authentic place and raises the profile of cities in conversations with regards to where we're going to spend money. And, how are we going to build new infrastructure? Are we going to reinvest in existing infrastructure? And what are we going to do with sprawl? And, I think if cities aren't appropriately positioned in those conversations, I think society suffers.
Amen.
We're really looking to just kind of reframe the current urban narrative and get people to realize, geez, you know what? This kind of stuff can only happen in cities. And we better preserve and take care of our cities.
Brian Boylehead's Issue Media Group, publisher of Pop City in Pittsburgh and Model D in Detroit. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. All across the country, children have spent the summer vacationing with family and friends. But trips to the lake, backyard barbecues, and late evening play are being replaced with back-to-school preparations. This week, City View's commentator Walker Smith looks at how our sense of smell is linked to early childhood experiences.
On summer afternoons, I'm often lulled to sleep on my porch by the sound of mowers and the rich, pungent smell of freshly cut grass. It's a smell that takes me back to childhood summers when the long shadows of late afternoons would fall across the neighborhood back lawns that combined to create a vast playground where all of the local kids would play freeze tag or kick the can until the last light of dusk finally winked out. I would come home with grass stains on my elbows and knees that my mother would make me scrub off before I went to bed. The smell of cut grass triggers vivid memories of those days long ago. I remember the sweat and laughter and bickering and joy of running through those yards, always freshly mown, kicking up pieces of grass and the heads of dandelions as me and my friends dashed from one hiding place to the next. We were completely at ease in our backyard universe of clotheslines, sandboxes, and cement stoops. In the gloaming of the day, the cooling air would release the smell of cut grass into the gathering breezes that would build as we made our ways home. I would go to sleep with these breezes wafting through my open bedroom windows. Smell is a powerful trigger of memories. There is a famous passage in Proust's Remembrance of Things Past in which he writes of childhood memories triggered by the taste and smell of a spoonful of tea in which he had soaked a small piece of Madeleine cake. With a shudder, Sunday mornings with his aunt, her house, and the whole town with its people, gardens, and churches took shape in his mind. Smells are processed by a mere 1% of our brains. Yet smells have a special ability to affect us because they connect with both the limbic system controlling emotions and the cortex controlling conscious thought. University of Stockholm psychologist Maria Larsson has found that visual or verbal information is most likely to trigger memories formed between the ages of 15 and 30. Memories formed between the ages of 5 and 10, however, are most likely to be triggered by olfactory information. Smells take us directly to our childhoods. Smell and taste develop first and are active in the womb. Foods that our mothers ate during their pregnancies become taste and smells we prefer. No surprise, then, that these senses are most strongly evocative of our earliest memories. The direct connection of smells with emotions makes these early memories particularly powerful. It's interesting that what connects us most to the communities of our childhoods gets the least attention in community planning and development. The things we plan for are visual, tactile, and auditory, sight lines and elevations, or playgrounds and traffic control, texture and field, or noise abatement and sound barriers. Yet our memories take root in other ways. Still, perhaps it's best that at least one part of ourselves escapes our obsession for control, to catch us unaware sometimes and bring us a whiff of simpler, carefree days. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart City's web content and audio archive is supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders working to speed innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.